on Beyond Nitro. It's Guy Evans with you once again, and I am joined by a man who wears many hats. He's a husband, father, realtor, ring announcer, of course, and now, as of April of this year, author of the new book, Sitting Ringside, Volume 1. Of course, I'm talking about none other than David Penzer. Dave, how are you doing today?
How you doing, Guy? Good.
So this is the first time we've ever spoke, right?
Yeah, no, I think we spoke briefly once before, about 30 seconds.
Yeah, I think it's the number of chats we've had now are probably into the triple figures. Let's put it that way. We've talked a lot over the last few months in putting together this new book, Sitting Ringside Volume 1, which I was so pleased to be a part of. And it was one of those projects that the longer we got into it, the more excited I was about the final product. And I'm very proud of the book now that it's completed and out there for everyone to read. What has this experience been like for you? Let's kind of start there. You know, as we're recording this, we're about 2 months in to the book being up for sale. What has it been like for you to say that you now have an autobiography in the wrestling category and to see the great feedback and reviews coming in? Take us into your mindset at the moment.
Well, I'm going to keep with the theme of this book and this week, especially being a kiss ass. You know, luckily I had you to tell my story, man, because I never planned, as you know, to do an autobiography. This is originally supposed to be a scrapbook. And you saw something that was there that I didn't think was of value and convinced me that it was of value and did a fantastic, tremendous, incredible job of telling that story, my story. It's been pretty whirlwind. It's all been so therapeutic. You know, talking to you was therapeutic, and then doing these interviews have been therapeutic. There's one that Cody Diener just dropped, part two of that. You should check out Cody Diener on social media, but that got me emotional, which I never saw coming in a million years at the end. So it's been a roller coaster, man. It's it's a lot of things I never thought of before. You know, people wanted to know, and as I was explaining it, I was learning things about myself and my journey that I just hadn't thought of. So it's been unique for sure, but I've enjoyed it.
And I would say, in turn, you know, you just did such a wonderful job of allowing me to pretty much ask any question that I wanted and to go into any particular direction that came up. And there were kind of no questions off the table. It was no holds barred. So, I mean, a book is only as good as its subject. And I thought you just were so great to work with. Let me ask you this, you know, because this was kind of my impression in going back and looking at your story and thinking of, you know, the great era of wrestling that you were involved in, but also just the entirety of your career and just how long you've been around the business and so many legends that you've worked with, and kind of the ultimate fly on the wall account, really. I think this book is, you know, all the rooms that you've been in and all of the situations that you've kind of found yourself in. Do you sometimes even today kind of find yourself pinching yourself a little bit, like, man, I actually did it. Like I grew up a huge fan, as you talk about in the book, and I wanted to be a part of the business, and I was able to be a part of the business at arguably its absolute height, and your story is even still going today. Is that kind of hard to believe at times?
I pinch myself on probably a daily basis. it's absolutely insane. You know, the story is of what I had to do to get my pinky toe in the door of two companies, one that was more easy because it was smaller, and one that was near impossible back in the 1990s. It's just, you know, it's a testament that if you keep showing up and you mind your own business and you work hard and you show value, that, and I'm not putting myself over, I'm just saying this is what I've discovered in this journey, is that you got a shot at doing anything. If anybody out there has a dream, you know, I'm not saying you're going to accomplish that dream, but, you know, there's a shot, but you got it. Like I said, you know, you got to work hard and keep showing up, and mind your own business and be helpful, be provide value. And, I think if you do that, you got a pretty decent shot, because people like somebody who minds their own business, always shows up and provides value.
Absolutely. And I know in the interviews that we did for the book, and as we kind of alluded to earlier, there were a lot of them. You emphasized on many occasions that, the wrestling business of the late 80s, early 90s, when you were getting your foot in the door, very, very different scenario and situation from today, especially as it relates to someone trying to get into the business without, a whole lot of connections, let's say. Could you kind of paint that picture for the listeners? They can obviously read about it in a lot more detail in the book, but if you had to contrast those two worlds, getting into the wrestling business circa, let's say, 1988, 1989 versus today, how different are those two different situations?
I mean, in the early 1990s, when I broke in with WCW for as a, like I say, Stooge of the Year, you just people like me didn't go weren't allowed in backstage. Maybe if it was somebody's kids, like Ric Flair's kids, they would go backstage. But I know Jeff Jarrett didn't get smartened up for for until he was a teenager. So, and he sort of figured out some things because they were taping promos in his backyard for Kamala and people like that. But, it just didn't happen. It was, I look back and I still, Jody Hamilton is the key to that, success. And, God bless him. And I miss him tremendously. He's been gone. When I had the Sitting Ringside podcast that I had him on and I asked him, I said, "You saw something in me that wasn't there. What was it?" And he said, he said, "I saw somebody who was excited and anxious to learn." But still in that business back in those days, if you weren't a referee or a wrestler or a part of the office, you didn't get that opportunity. He gave me an opportunity that nobody really got. I'll forever be grateful. Obviously we go into great detail in the book, but and once I got that opportunity, as we said, I just never stopped, never missed a show, never missed a taping. Hey, I was bringing enhancement guys. I don't know if I even told you this, but I was bringing enhancement guys to a taping one time, and we rolled a van and we went in the police car. Back and the police car drove us to the rental, another budget rental, which is what we used. I rented another van and I made it in time.
Wow. Damn, are we?
There wasn't anything short of, we talk about my anxiety and the crazy rides that I had crisscrossing the state of Florida. Nothing was going to stop me from getting up there and bring in those guys. And, actually, now that I think about it, I think that really opened a lot of people's eyes when we showed up, because they had heard we rolled the van and I got word out. But, I think that opened some people's eyes that, when we actually walked in, people were like, "Wow." You could see, they didn't really say anything, but it's like, "Holy crap, they're here."
Wow. Well, we're gonna have to find a way to shoehorn that story into
Yeah, I don't
volume
know why we
two.
didn't put that.
I know. I'm like kicking myself now. I'm like, damn, okay, we'll figure it out. Because for the listeners who may be unaware, there's so much to tell when it comes to David's career, and of course, so many additional sort of bonus materials that we put into this new book in terms of the last Nitro format and all of these historic, not only formats, but documents and notes relating to his time in WCW that we actually decided to do two volumes. So we're going to figure out a way to get that story into volume two. Let me ask you this. You talk about your work ethic, that's evident. You talk about your attitude, that shines through in the book. But you also have to have talent as well, right? You can be the hardest working person in the world, but if you're not actually able to deliver when your number's called, then that's obviously a different story. Now, with that being said, I'm curious to know, how did you develop your style as a ring announcer, right? Because again, you started driving the guys up. You were, as you put it, the stooge of the year. You were willing to do anything that was necessary to help out the company. But when it came time for you to actually step up into a ring announcer role, how did you develop such a distinctive style that people remember and actually imitate a lot of your ring announcing all of these years later? How did that come about?
Well, first of all, before I get to the answer to that question, that's why I was so petrified when I finally got my opportunity. because if I couldn't make it, if I couldn't do what I said I could do, there was no use. There's no reason to drive, a car full of wrestlers up there for $125 and a rental van that they paid me back for. So, that was like, that was the key point in this whole story, pretty much. I think I wouldn't you agree?
Absolutely. I mean, that was the that was your opportunity right there, right? And if you would have blown
Yeah.
that would have been the end of it.
People ask me about my style. I really don't have a good answer to that question. I was a mobile DJ back in high school. I did weddings, bar mitzvahs, sweet 16s, and then I when I was with Bob Roop after the Global Wrestling Alliance, we did indie show, a lot of indie shows promoting. We co-promoted them, and we owned a ring together. And I just, when it came time to do my thing in Macon, Georgia, for my tryout, I just did me. I was so worried about screwing up. I wasn't even thinking, what's my style going to be? And I've never really thought about that. And I've told some people that story, and it blows their mind. I guess other people really focus on that, but I was just went out there and did David Penzer and didn't think twice about it, quite frankly. And that's why it blows my mind when I hear people, say that they did the David Penzer voice. It's like, that's crazy, because in my mind, there really isn't David Penzer voice. Just me announcing the matches in the way that I did. So sorry if that's not a great answer, but that's the truth.
No, I think that's an even better answer. And, as you were saying that, it just kind of made me think sometimes some of the more distinctive styles or the way that people do their thing in front of the camera come about, without a deliberate kind of thought process beforehand, right? Like, this is going to be who I am as a ring announcer. You went out there and did it, and people still remember it so fondly to this day.
A lot of
Go.
guys back then were doing Howard Finkel. I revered Howard Finkel, so I would never have done him. Some people were doing Gary Michael Capetta. Gary passed the torch to me, passed the mic to me, and helped me out so tremendously. And I had so much respect and friendship for the guy. I would never have done that. So there was, like I said, there really wasn't a lot of thought in it. I wasn't going to do Howard Finkel. I wasn't going to do Gary Capetta. That would have been a slap in the face to him. So I just went out and did me. And never in a million years, like I said before, would think that anybody was doing David Penzer voice. It's crazy. Still blows my mind when I hear it.
Now, one of the aspects of this book for the people who haven't read it yet, which I think really makes it quite unique, is your openness to talk about some of the mental health struggles that you've gone through really ever since your college years and how that's been kind of a recurring theme throughout your life. And the way that you talk about that particular subject, I think, is quite uplifting because you were able to fight through a lot of these challenges and still do your job and perform and contribute at a high level despite battling these things at times. Why was it so important to you that you wanted this to be a focus of the book? Because we probably could have told your story either touching on that or maybe not even going there entirely, but you were quite, I wouldn't say adamant, but you were very passionate about that actually being a recurring theme in the book. And I'm curious as to why.
Well, back then, when I was going through that, I still go through anxiety and panic attacks. But back in when I was doing it in WCW, you didn't really talk about it. Maybe I might tell Tony Schiavone, if I'm acting a little off, I'm not really my head's not really feeling together or something like that. And you kind of, just to let him know, But yeah, it was important. It's important to me because I it's funny. I say I got lucky. Nobody gets lucky when they have to battle for, most of their life, anxiety and panic attacks or mental health issues of any kind. But I got lucky in the fact that my dad was a psychologist and was sort of my rock throughout this whole thing. It's dawned on me, and I understand the fact that there's so many people out there that battle this that don't have somebody like that. And so if my voice could help inspire one person to fight another day, then I'm happy to do it. I'm not embarrassed. I'm an open book. I without my father there, I could honestly say that I probably would not be here right now. I mean, that's how dark it was for the first 6 months when this first when it first, it started get having panic and anxiety. And You know, there's been dark days and there's been better days, but it's, you know, but it's, and the one thing about anxiety is when you're in the dark place, you honestly believe, even if you've been there, you've been in that place 25 times, you honestly believe, your mind believes. And I always say the mind is a powerful thing, not always in a good way. But the mind wants you to believe you're never going to feel better again. Sometimes I have to tell myself, you know, you're going to feel better again. But it took probably 30 years of calling my dad, and it became a joke at one point because I'd be like, "Dad, I'm never going to feel but right again." And he's like, "We've had these discussions like 500 times, and you always feel better." And I said, "We, you know," and I say, "You know," and I would say, "Yeah, but you know, this time is different, you know," and because the mind can mess you up, man. It's a mind, you know what? And you know, there's a reason that word is used. So, you know, I was lucky enough to have somebody who understood what I was going through and had gone through what I was going through, to be able to talk me down. He's no longer here. We lost him about 18 months ago. And you know, if we would have lost him 10 years ago, I it might have been a different situation. But I was at a point, he had gotten me to the point where I could push through. And but there's a lot of people out there that can't push through, or it's very hard to push through. And I want them to know that I'm a living example of the fact that when you don't think it's gonna get better and you're sure, I mean, you'd bet your damn house, every dime you had, you're never gonna feel better. It's such a strange thing, that you will, but you gotta push forward. And if you push forward and you do some things that are uncomfortable doing, maybe, you know, cleaning your room or you know, tackling a project you haven't done, or you know, even getting into a book. I got a good book for you, by the way. But even getting to a book, and you know, it's hard to concentrate at the beginning, but once you get into it, it gets easier and easier, and the light comes out more, and the darkness fades for that for now. And you know, it's never happened to me that obviously that I felt like I was never going to feel better, and I didn't always feel better. So my message to people is, whoever's listening, whoever reads the book, you know, if you feel like you don't think that you could get past it, reach out for somebody to help you. And if you don't have anybody to help you, there's tons of hotlines out there, people that'll assist you. People that are waiting there, that most, a lot of them don't get paid, that just want to help people out, you know, in their darkest moments, and you know, get them to the next step. Because even though you're sure it doesn't, it does get better. And you know, it's something that most people, myself included, battle their whole life. You know, there was a couple nights ago that I was feeling odd, and I'm like, oh, what if I don't feel, you know, and I'm thinking this in my head, you know, what if I don't feel, you know, I always feel like this. And then I, you know, I'm like, David, you know, push through it, you know you're going to. And the next day I felt fine. So you know, I've been able, like I said, I don't want to go sound like a broken record, but I'm so passionate about it. Life is so precious, you know. I believe you only live once, and you know, to cut that short because of your mind effing with you, when you can get through it, and it's not easy, and it doesn't feel good. It's the worst kind of pain I've ever felt in my life, but you could get there. So I'm passionate about that. And anything I could do to get that message out there, I will always do in a heartbeat.
Well, those are words certainly to live by. And I think if people dig into the book, there'll be a lot of talk related to what you were going into there that will really inspire and uplift them if they're having, you know, similar problems. And so I think that really does, as I mentioned before, make the book so unique. Switching gears a little bit, you and I, Dave, have had some conversations over the last couple of weeks about the new WCW series on Vice, Who Killed WCW? And you know that there's so much emphasis on the demise of WCW and when things fell apart and all of the mistakes that were made. And I suppose that's natural because I think we tend to gravitate more to the negative, especially within the context of a television show or something like that. But I want to ask you about something different. I want to ask you about the good times, because I think a lot of times that sort of gets left on the table, the fact that for quite some time, WCW really reached some heights and successes that were just kind of beggared belief at that particular point in time. When you think about not everything that went wrong at the end and the company, you getting sold and going out of business and all that. But when you think about, you know, those sold out arenas and being the number one wrestling company in the world at that time, what are some memories that kind of flash through your mind? Take us back to that time as someone who was quite literally ringside, as we mentioned in the title of the book, witnessing all of this historic stuff happen around them.
Well, lucky for me, time, you know, there's a saying that says time heals all wounds. And lucky for me, over the years, I've forgot or not really focused on the bad stuff. I've remembered and embraced the good stuff, the good times, the good stuff when we were on top. It's a shame some people can't do that. And look, I love Bret Hart. He's so talented. And nice is one of the nicest guys in the business, and I have so much respect for him. I can't even tell you, but I just feel sad for him that it seems like he can't get past it all these years later. And I know his situation is different. It happened. Things happened to him and his family, and you know that kind of stuff didn't happen to me. So I understand that, but I'm sad for him that you know he still sounds as bitter as he sounds, and you know. I hope more people are like me and not like him. And again, I'm not comparing my story to his story because, you know, it's totally, you know, totally different circumstances. But still, you know, there were some things that happened to me that really upset me. Nothing like what happened to Brett, but, you know, that I don't even really think about anymore, you know, or I laugh about. That's my take. That's all I could tell you. I can't talk about anybody else's. I would hope that everybody else, you know, would can get to where I am at some point in their life, but circumstances are certainly different, and you know, egos are certainly different, and you know, I don't have I don't fault anybody if they can't get there. I just feel sad because, as I said earlier, you know, you only live once, and you know, want to focus on the good times. So that's what I try to do, and yeah, I don't really have any bad feelings about it. When we were going through it, it was crazy, especially the bad part, the bad stuff. You know, it was like a Nitro day was like being on a roller coaster, and I'm just a ring announcer. So at least for most of the time, but it's all kind of eased itself away, and you know, look, I still remember, you know, how, and we get in this in the book, and I know that it's become something because he unfriended me on Twitter, unfortunately, because it's nothing personal. But on a professional level, I still don't like the booking of Vince Russo, his booking, and we get into that in depth. So he's obviously upset at me, and I didn't mean anything personally by it. Look, it's not my cup of tea. It might be somebody else might love it. You know, Game Changer Wrestling, when you know, Brett Lauderdale is a great guy. He's actually one of the people who said I used to do the David Penzer voice the first time I met him. Brilliant businessman. But to me, when you bring out a light bulb, you lost me. I don't want to watch. Well, I don't watch his shows. But his shows are very successful. So he's reaching an audience out there that is making him profitable and making a lot of people in the business a nice little living or good living. And but when I look at Vince, there might have been some people that liked it, but the ratings went down, the attendance went down, the everything went down. So, you know, there weren't enough people who there's enough people who like you know, the blood and gut stuff that Mike Johnson, that Brett Lauderdale could make a good living. There weren't enough people that liked the crash television stuff that Vince was doing that could sustain a company profitable. And so that's my two cents on it. It wasn't my cup of tea. It'll never be my cup of tea. And I think more people probably agree with me than liked it. And at the end of the day, if he had done something in his writing career, you know, that, you know, he could look back and say the Attitude Era and whatever part he had in that, hats off, tip of the cap, man. You know, that's debatable, and I don't know the truth, so I'm not going to even guess. He was obviously a force, but when he was left to his own vices, he went some places that in my opinion were a little outside of the fun of the Attitude Era, and just got almost went ridiculous. there's fun, and then there's like over the top ridiculous, and I just think he couldn't help himself. And but that's just my two cents. I'm not afraid to say it. It's not personal. I wish him the best. I like Vince. He's a nice guy. There's nothing wrong with him. But we just don't see eye to eye, and that's okay. I don't think he killed WCW, but at the end of the day, I don't think he helped WCW, if that makes any sense. You're gonna mince words. You didn't kill it, but you didn't help it. And and again, just my opinion. Everybody's allowed to have an opinion. And I'm one of those people, like, I don't get hot about other people's opinions. If somebody, if you said to me today, I disagree with you, David, and this is why, and this is why, and I think Vince Russo was really good for the business, I would say, you know what, guy, me and you disagree, but God bless you. Think what you want to think. That's your right, as it's a free country. So, it's just my opinion, but I just don't think he helped. And if you're not helping, then you're getting paid, then you're not doing your job, in my opinion. That's, again, just my two cents.
Now, speaking of helping, you mentioned the word help. Let me throw this one at you. To what extent did one Brad Siegel help WCW as a company, particularly during its last days as a Turner-owned entity? And I think you would be very apt to talk about this based on the fact that if people don't know, you were involved in the booking process at the end of the company. What were your impressions of Brad Siegel at that time? And as I said in my original question, to what extent do you think he was a help rather than a hindrance at the end?
Well, it's funny, this whole process and the whole WCW and your Nitro book and the docuseries and all that, which the if you don't have the Nitro book, by the way, guys, and girls, please get it. I want you to buy my book, but that book is the encyclopedia of WCW, to the point where I was amazed at the people you were able to speak to. But
Thank you.
that probably never wanted to remember and took off their resume that they had anything to do with professional wrestling. I hadn't thought about Brad Siegel. Why would I? And then he shows up on this documentary looking different than I remember. And we all change with age. Although Bret Hart says I always look the same. So thank you, Bret. You start thinking about it, and you start hearing him talk, and then I started thinking about it, and I'm like, this is my opinion. I could be wrong, just like in my opinion on Vince. But I think Brad Siegel gave up on the company. I think that Brad Siegel, had he believed in WCW or even wanted to give WCW under Eric and Fuse Media a chance, could have certainly had enough power, maybe not to prolong the inevitable, because the inevitable was the inevitable at that point, but could have given us a shot to keep going and not just kill it, with 3 days' notice. That's part speculation, and that's part, from things I heard. And he was not helpful, and that's fine. If you don't believe it, that's fine. But then walk away, and let's bring in somebody who could be helpful. If I'm the if I if I'm a oh, I was on my CDD. It's a local board of in your community, where you're on a board, and like you have to get voted in by the people in your community and the regular ballots. And anyway, not to get too much in the weeds, but I've been on my CDD for 20 years. I was the chairman for 15. If I ever got to a point where I didn't believe that I was helpful, that I didn't believe that the CDD was a good thing and could be used for good, to keep the community beautiful and have a great golf course and a nice sports bar that you've been to, I'd walk away. Why stay and be a detriment? And so, and I'm just, that's the first thing that came to mind to kind of compare it to. But I just think he did such a disservice. I don't even think he was one of those guys. And I've learned a lot, in that last episode the other day, where he said Eric basically did everything I asked him to do. I don't even think he was one of those guys that disliked WCW like so many in Turner management. I just think he got put in charge. And then, you know, you think about it, I almost don't blame him. I just wish he would have walked away and put somebody in there fresh. But you know, he got put in charge right around the time that, you know, Hogan laid down, Jeff Jarrett laid down, and Hogan walked out, and Russo cut the promo, and there was a lawsuit. And it's like, that was his introduction into, being the direct boss. He had been a cog in the wheel. You would know better than I. But that was the introduction of him being, with lack of Eric, being the guy that answers the ultimate question of what happens. So I would understand if Brad Siegel said, "Look, I was burnt out and I didn't really believe anymore." But my point would be back to Brad. Well, you should have walked away, and you should put somebody in there that would have fought for us a little bit harder. Instead of just ending everything in 3 days. You know, people ask me why I think people are still so enamored with the whole Monday Night Wars and the death of WCW. I found out the company got sold on a Saturday. I flew to Panama City on a Sunday. We did the last show on Monday, and by Wednesday, we were kicked out of our offices. Our computers all got shut down. Well, before we could, try to keep anything, even if it was like a personal item, and we talk about that in the book too in depth. But I just don't. I don't think people invest. And you know this more than anybody. People invested a lot of their time and a lot of money. You know, NWO shirts weren't cheap even back then. Action figures and Nitro parties and pay-per-view tickets and pay-per-view buys. You know, people really followed along. Now, as we went through what we went through, less people followed, but those that stayed, they were the hardcore ones. They were like, "I'm WCW all the way, even if this it's not very good anymore." And I've heard people say that. You know, I stuck with it only because I was dedicated to it, wanted to see where it was going to go, but I didn't particularly like it at some points. So, those people, all of a sudden, in within 72 hours, that's it. That's it. That's the end. It goes away. You know, there's no, at the end of like a TV series, they say, like if you're watching TV series about a murder trial, 12 jurors convicted this person, the person he attacked is doing better, but you at least get an update. There's no update. It went away and it never came back. And I think people just can't, there's, you know, my, can't wrap their heads around the fact that that's it. You know, they want closure, and there is no closure to give, unfortunately.
Well, speaking of closure, unfortunately, that's going to bring us to the end of this month's edition of Beyond Nitro. But Dave, first of all, it's been a pleasure to speak with you in this kind of format and even learn a couple of things that I wish we would have included in the first book, but we will find a way to put them in the second book. So I'm glad to have learned about those things. And I just want to give you the last sort of 30 seconds here. If people haven't checked out the book so far, and are looking for information on how to read it and anything else you'd like to leave the listeners with after what I think has been a fantastic interview.
Thank you. I appreciate that. You're back at you. This is the kind of chemistry we have, obviously, which is why the book has become so entertaining. You know, when people like Chris Jericho and Charles Robinson and people like that read it and say, tell me, call me, not on, not like, promoting it, but just call me on a personal level or reach out to me on a personal level and say how much they enjoyed it. And, I agreed with this, but I didn't realize I saw this thing from a different perspective. But when I read your perspective, it opened my eyes, people I went through the journey with. I just want to, you can follow me on Twitter at David Penzer. That's always fun. No politics or anything like that. Just a lot of wrestling and some other of my hobbies.
DavidPenzerBook.com, GuyEvansBooks.com, or Amazon.com.
Beautiful. My guest this month, David Penza, the book, Sitting Ringside Volume 1, as Dave told everyone there, available at DavidPenzerBook.com and Amazon. Dave, once again, thank you so much for the time. It's been a lot of fun.
You know, the one thing about me is I love talking about professional wrestling, so never have to twist my arm on that.
Not at all. All right. Thanks so much, Dave. Appreciate it.
Yes, sir. You too.